In today's episode,
what does Ethereum represent? What does a network that is not run by a single company and a single board of directors, a single CEO, that there needs to be an alternative in the marketplace for that. And I think that is where Rally's headed. I'm really, there's no company or person even that runs Bitcoin. And similarly, there's nothing about Ethereum that does that. And that's where Rally is headed to, which is as we grow the Rally network, we will dissolve Rally Corporation in such that there will be no company that runs the Rally network. And it will be a true open sourced, open protocol that anybody, any creator, any brand, can create their own forms of digital currency.
Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. Today's episode is with Kevin Chu. He's the CEO and co-founder of Rally.io, a crypto platform that allows creators to launch their own digital currency and build independent economies with their communities. His company is backed by some of the best in the business, from Andreessen Horowitz to Coinbase Ventures and even the founders of Twitch. Kevin is also the chairman of Gen G, an esports enterprise bridging Asia and North America. Previously, he co-founded Kabam, a top mobile gaming company that grew to $400 million a year in revenue, 500 million players, and sold for nearly $1 billion. In this conversation, you will learn all about the emerging waves Kevin thinks entrepreneurs should be building on top of, from AI, crypto, climate change, and biotech, the evolution of the gaming industry and its business models, the rise of social gaming, esports, streaming, and where we're at today, the Gartner hype cycle and how this applies to crypto, how and why Rally is empowering creators to develop their own economies, why there's a need for decentralized alternatives, and he even makes a case for why there should be a decentralized social network. This was a wild conversation for me to prepare for. Kevin has a crazy track record, and it's often ideas like this that seem crazy at first but are inevitable in hindsight. If you're new here, make sure you're subscribed. I have an episode for you every single Wednesday. Let us know what you think of this on Twitter. I'm at BZady and he's at Kevin Chu. Links in the show notes below. We'll get straight into the show after a brief message from our sponsors. This week's episode is sponsored by Space, the easiest way to engage your team over audio. Space helps remote teams have engaging discussions over audio. You can create rooms that are always open, as well as scheduled or live discussions, so your team can communicate without meeting links and friction. To learn more, book a time with an onboarding expert at joinspace.co. And I also want to thank our sponsor, MicroAcquire, the largest startup acquisition marketplace. If you're looking to sell your SaaS company, get access to more than 50,000 trusted buyers and say goodbye to brokers and huge fees. It's entirely free for founders and private with no middlemen. If you're looking to buy a SaaS company, choose from hundreds of vetted startups. Most deals close in 30 days. Check it out and sign up at microacquire.com. Now let's get straight into the show. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, man. Listen, in prep for this interview, I have to say this was one of the wildest nights of my research time doing the podcast, because I think when we first spoke over Twitter and Clubhouse, I was like, oh, you seem like you're doing something interesting right now with Rally, which we'll get into, obviously, later in the conversation. But then when I started digging into your past, I was like, wow, you've been doing so many amazing things and crazy things, like worlds that I know almost nothing about, especially in the gaming space, esports. And it's a really fascinating world to me from the outside. So really excited to dig into a lot of that today with you.
I'm looking forward to it.
So before we get into like your full background, maybe a good place to start for us is gaming as a passion for you, because I know growing up it sounds like you were always a gaming fan. But where did that come from?
I grew up in a very small town and my parents were immigrants, and so we lived on kind of the outskirts of a small town called Moorpark, and it's about 10,000 people, and we lived on this giant hill sort of away from the rest of the town. And I really didn't have, it was hard to, make friends. And for whatever reason, I just preferred to, read books. And then when I got a little bit older, I started to get into games. My father was he worked in the defense industry programming missiles. And
that's insane.
Yeah, so he worked on one missile program for 10 years, and so we always had a bunch of PCs and random, you know, parts and hardware that he would bring home from work, and I would kind of tinker with it and put it together. And of course, you know, doing all that was all about trying to get the latest game to work on the PC. And so he and his coworkers always shared, back then they were called shareware games. And so you would kind of share these different floppy disks, and they, you know, the entire game would run, you know, off of one little floppy disk. And a lot of these games were either, you know, very low graphics or no graphics. And I just had a blast, you know, playing with them and getting it all to work. So gaming to me was kind of both understanding technology. You know, back then you had to, you know, configure the PC in certain ways to run certain games. And so kind of messing with all that, getting, you know, the mouse to work, which was a relatively new invention back then, getting the first hard drive installed and then putting a game onto a hard drive as opposed to having the game run off of a floppy disk. So all these things were sort of fun memories and technical challenges of getting like the most basic games to work, but it was so much fun. And eventually, you know, as I went to elementary school and middle school, I started finding other friends who are into games, and then just kind of connected with other people through games. Really enjoyed it from my childhood. So, and never thought anything would come of it. My parents encouraged me to go into, you know, finance. So that's what I did. I studied business at UC Berkeley and then went into investment banking. And later on, as I was going through my career, I was like, you know, I'm just not enjoying this. And so many things were happening in the gaming industry in the mid 2000s. And it just led me to think, you know what, I'm going to go try to start a company to make games and pursue my passion as opposed to finance, which I really did not enjoy at the time. And started Kabam in 2006, 2007, and had a blast running that company for 11 years, making about 50 games in our lifetime. And
crazy.
Over 500 million users playing our games. And so that was just a really fun time to be part of the gaming industry as the games moved from PC to consoles, kind of in the late 90s and 2000s. And then it was starting to move into the internet. And it was just a great time to be in the gaming industry and pioneering new business models with free-to-play and microtransactions. And then now with games like Fortnite and others, now even Call of Duty, moving to free-to-play, we have pretty much every game on every platform exploring free-to-play or microtransactions in some form.
Got it, man. Yeah, and it's just an interesting, you're the second person this week that I've spoken to who moved from finance to something they were a bit more passionate about. It ended up being tech. The guy I'm talking about was the founder of NerdWallet, if you know them. It's interesting because similar to you, I graduated probably just a few years after you did. And when I was graduating, basically at the height of the recession, 2007-08, I also went to business school and everyone wanted to become an investment banker or a consultant. And then we saw like the collapse of the industry. And my dad was actually in banking, but and I liked numbers, so I was kind of interested in it, but I was always like an internet kid as well. Never saw examples of people that I could say, oh, that person's doing something I'm interested in. And I don't normally even talk about this, but like someone who looked and felt like me. And I don't mean look just as like a Pakistani Indian looking person, because of course there's plenty of those people, plenty of Pakistani Indians in tech, but I meant someone who looked like someone who came from my background, growing up in London with a certain demographic. And it just, I didn't have examples. So I'm curious for you, were there examples that you'd looked at and said, oh, that person was an entrepreneur and therefore I feel confident enough to just leave and start a business?
That is a great question. I had the fortune to work for a venture capital firm called Kenan Partners, which is a early stage firm. And I remember we had done one of the first investments the firm made was in a company called Blurb. And this was kind of print on demand books and allowed anybody to print their own books. And about a year into that company, the company was approached by a big, very big public company, a Fortune 50 company, to go buy this small little company that had just started. And I was working with the CEO, Eileen Gittens, on a number of things, helping her set up her office and get the IT network set up and help her do her first financial model for the board meeting and just kind of getting the company set up. And I remember sitting in this meeting with this Fortune 500 company and the CEO and the venture capitalist that I was working with, the partner, John Balin. We're sitting in this massive conference room talking about what a deal structure would look like and the economics of the deal. And Eileen turns to me and she says, can you run the numbers real quick on what this means for all the shareholders? And so I was kind of sitting there playing with my Excel model. I said, okay, well, Canaan Partners would make this much, the other investors would make that much, and then the CEO, founder, would make this much. And I was like, wow, this is unbelievable. For 1 year of work, the CEO would make, you know, X millions of dollars. There's many millions. I just think to myself, this is incredible. This company just got started a year ago. And the deal value was nothing humongous and ultimately didn't consummate. But I remember thinking to myself, wow, I could be working for the next 20 years and not make this much money. And it just got me thinking about what it is to own something and have equity value and have kind of true ownership of a thing, as opposed to just working for a company and giving my labor in return for a salary. And, you know, doing those quick calculations, I was obviously coming from a finance background. I just said, wow, this is how wealth is truly created, not, you know, working 9 to 5 for a big company and climbing the corporate ladder for 20 years. And so that was kind of my first inclination that I wanted to start a company. I didn't know what company to start at that time. And so I spent 2 more years at Canaan Partners, had amazing experience, learning experience, working with all the partners there. And that did give me the confidence eventually to eventually start Kabam. It was seeing all the different entrepreneurs come in the door. And a lot of times these companies, when they're first formed, even if they're a Series A funded company, they're really rough around the edges. It's hard to imagine sort of, you know, we look at the Airbnbs or Ubers or obviously the Googles or Facebooks, you know, now say, wow, it's like an amazing company with world-class, you know, people and everything looks polished. But really when these things first start, they all look very, very rough. And just seeing that progression of how raw something is, and then the transformation as the years go by to a full-blown company that looks professional from the outside, gave me a lot of confidence that, you know what, it's not this magical thing that happens from, you know, an amazing talented group and it just starts looking really professional. Every company starts looking a little bit raw, and that kind of insight that, you know, it doesn't need to be perfect when the company first starts. It doesn't need to have its strategy figured out. It doesn't need to have its first product, you know, looking like a product from Microsoft. You know, they can be much more raw as long as it serves a real customer need in the marketplace was a big insight that gave me confidence.
That's also, I love that story of just like seeing the numbers, because sometimes it's reading a book, or sometimes it's seeing a film, or like for some people it was like watching Shark Tank or Dragon's Den in the UK and saying like, oh, that looks kind of cool being on the other side of the table or pitching it on that side. But like, I'm sure I'm similar to you as well, which is like numbers translate well for me. So when I just see the numbers, I'm like, this doesn't make much sense. Like, you know, and if you had another role, which was employees, and that's not to say employees aren't gaining from the upside, because a lot of time they get stocks or like shares in the company and upside there, but they also get the flip side, which is stability and a salary, and they're not taking as much risk, obviously. But yeah, I mean, when I moved to the States, that's just something I kind of really leaned into, which was like, we're in a capitalist system. We can talk for 5 hours about the pros and cons and that, and if that's the perfect system, the way that it currently lives. I was like, if I'm here, this is what works, and there's upside. Like, the system is designed for people to create things and to fail many times, and sometimes they actually create value and there's a lot of upside for them. So thanks for sharing that, man. I think that's an important thing for everyone to like look out for in their own lives, because those are the kind of moments that like take you in certain directions. To go into that a little bit deeper, let's say you've now decided you want to start a company at some point, you've planted that seed, But then a lot of people, like I'm pretty sure everyone listening to this show either has a company or wants to have a company. So I think we've all agreed on that point. The next step though is, what do I do and how do I get into something? And for you, it ended up being gaming, which you were passionate about. I'm curious, like, how you thought about a passion as well as like a business opportunity and that balance.
There's many different paths, I think, for people to look at this. So what I'll get into is probably just certainly just my own perspective and one path to how this works. So I generally am a risk-taking type of a person. And so the way I think about starting a company and kind of trying to align a passion, kind of our intellect, for me, things that are personally and intellectually interesting, and in a market opportunity, I kind of want to align all of those things. And I feel like those are kind of where some of the magic happens. So I personally, from a business standpoint, I think one of the most important things from a marketplace standpoint is to find something relatively new. You know, technology, if you're interested in technology or starting something that leverages technology to either deliver a service or a product, I do think it tends to be helpful to be really, really early in a new technology trend. As technology trends only last, you know, depending on kind of what platforms and so forth, you're talking about 5 to 8 year cycles, and then something new, you know, happens. And not all technology trends end up being as big as people think in the early days. So Gartner very famously has their hype cycle. And so you have this incredible hype in the beginning, and then it kind of falls off into the valley of disillusionment, and it kind of, you know, real value builds. So you could, you know, you could have something like mobile smartphones, which obviously that has exploded and more than lived up to its promise from the early days. And then you have things like VR or other things that you know, maybe kind of are in the trough of disillusionment a little bit, although I think there's real value that will be built over time. So I think look for things that are relatively new still, even if this is where the personal interest and passion kind of comes from. If you find something that you can be really passionate about when a new technology platform or trend is emerging, you can kind of get through the hype cycle, get through the trough of disillusionment because you're actually personally passionate and engaged about it, and then hopefully build real value in the end. And this has certainly happened in the crypto industry many times, actually. And so, you know, when Ethereum first launched, huge hype, and then it kind of died down kind of in the 2015, 2016 timeframe. And in late 2017, early 2018, you had this incredible boom again around Ethereum, which is when I started Rally. And then we went through later to, you know, the latter part of 2018, 2019, even the early parts of 2020, where there was a lot of disillusionment with kind of crypto in general. And then now sort of early 2021, there's a lot of interest in crypto again, kind of very broad-based in Bitcoin and Ethereum and a number of other crypto projects. And if I wasn't passionate about it, I don't think I would have got through the last 2 years of really slogging through the tough times without anybody caring. In many ways, crypto, you know, there's a lot of naysayers about crypto. And so sort of slogging through that takes kind of that personal interest and passion. It takes kind of an intellectual curiosity about what is real about this new technology and this new business model, and then kind of putting it all together within a broader market trend. That's kind of real, I think, where a lot of real magic happens. And so I would encourage listeners, if you're thinking about building a new business, try to identify a new technology trend that you think will continue to be a major shift, and try to be early in it. And if you're early, there's a lot of ways that you can fail. There's a lot of ways that you can stumble, but still being early enough in a marketplace allows you to not have to compete against major competitors from day one, but really kind of find your niche, find your customer base, find the customer need in the marketplace and try to serve it as best you can. And then I think one of the magics of any business is you need the market to eventually carry you. And it's hard to do that when you're late in a market cycle or a technology cycle, because the kind of the market wave has kind of passed you already. And it's, you know, while you can still build a great business by being, you know, late in a in a technology trend, it's just much harder to build the business.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I agree that there's different schools of thought on this, and this is just one point of view. But I definitely agree with you that in general, like if you're going to make a success of something like what you're doing, which I know we'll get into the details of what that is shortly, this is a big, big idea. This is not just something like, hey, let me just create something on the side that's going to bring me some money every month, which is, I'm not against people doing that either. And in fact, I think that's great. But for something like this that is really swinging for the fences, you do need to be on a wave, like you said. And if you're going to be able to last doing it, you need to be interested enough. Like money is not going to be enough of a motivator for most people. Though, of course, that's a big part of it. Always, but you need to be intellectually stimulated, like you said. You need to feel like you're solving challenging problems. You're creating something that's bigger than yourself potentially. So that's really interesting. A follow up question to what you just said there is that 5 to 8 year cycle of new trends. You did this previously with gaming, which is always one of the most innovative industries when it comes to new technology. And that included other waves like mobile, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
And now you're part of this blockchain wave, if you want a blockchain crypto wave with what you're doing. I'd say you're also kind of a part of the creator economy wave, which is another big one. Are there a few others that are top of mind for you that you've observed and said, oh, that's a really interesting wave that I think might be coming? But I don't have time to work on that, that maybe other people can go and explore.
AI, I think, will for sure change. It will be a massive, massive wave. And there's multiple sort of different directions and sectors of AI. But I do think that is part of one of the other fields that's super interesting. I think climate change, I really encourage. I think a lot of people are really passionate about that, and rightfully so. And we all need passionate entrepreneurs to solve big problems in climate change. And of course, there's multiple fields in that. Whether you want to create, you know, meatless meat or carbon, locking mechanisms and other things. So lots of really fascinating things in climate change. And I think, you know, with governments around the world, with new technologies being developed, there's just going to be a whole. I'm really excited about a whole wave of great entrepreneurs and companies that try to tackle that, you know, incredible problem for the world. And of course, in biotech, there's just a huge number of innovations that are happening. And so I think it's a great time to be exploring a lot of these new frontiers. And certainly I'm incredibly passionate about crypto, which hopefully we'll talk about it. I still think we're relatively early in the crypto wave as well.
Definitely. Well, that's awesome. And yeah, I think on a macro level, those are definitely the biggest waves. And even if you're looking at from where investors are spending their money, like the Andreessen Horowitz who've invested in your company, like they've got different sectors that they're focused in on. And I think those are definitely the top ones. So let's paint a picture of Rally as it is today. We're going to do a deep dive into Rally in the second part and do a lead up from your gaming background. But just so people have the context for what Rally is, like what is Rally at a high level?
Rally is a, we call it a network for, a crypto network for creators and their fans to tokenize their brand with cryptocurrency as well as NFTs and digital assets. And what this means is that you as the creator, you literally own the money that you, in the payment methods and the economics of your kind of digital brand, and you can build that economy and share the value creation with the fans that you have.
And just like I'm taking that in as you said that, like that is a huge huge idea, right? And your backers represent the biggest names in the industry, as I mentioned, Andreessen Horowitz, Coinbase Ventures, the founders of Twitch, Cultural Leadership Fund, a bunch of these amazing folks. A lot of the initial people that it looks like you're serving are adjacent to like the creator economy, whether that is like gamers who are streaming on Twitch and they've got a Discord community, and maybe some others on YouTube. Like, could you paint a picture of what that actually looks like? Because for a lot of people listening to this, they probably heard tokenization, NFTs, and some other acronyms that they might not actually know what they are. So just in simple terms, like, what does it look like for one of your customers and their community to use your service?
That's a great question. I know we're going to get into some esoteric things, but you're exactly right. The steps to take are, we try to make it as simple and straightforward as possible. So as a creator, you come and say, hey, I want to use Rally to mint my own cryptocurrency. So this is a real cryptocurrency token that lives on Ethereum. And it's your token. You mint it. You have your own smart contract that we basically set up for you. And you mint your own cryptocurrency. And when you mine when you get the first block of tokens, we work with creators to then give it out to their fans. And so, you know, if you're a, you know, podcaster like yourself, for example, that's been doing this for 5 years and you've got loyal listeners, you've got people who maybe help you edit, and distribute your podcast and so forth. We encourage creators to basically anybody that supported you, through your journey as a creator, how do you help them retroactively give them some of your cryptocurrency when you first create it for loyalty, for being a fan, or for you know, contributing work and services to help the creator be successful. So that's the first step. The second step then is you launch your token. And here, once that token becomes, once your fans and your supporters and your editors and moderators own your token, we launch the token. And then anybody in the world can then participate in your token. And this could be a hedge fund in Hong Kong. It could be somebody who's a new fan that starts listening to podcasts and say, hey, I love what Bilal is doing and I want to support this. I want to go buy the token and I want to donate it back, or I want to get access to a one-on-one interaction, or I want early access to content, whatever the case that the creator is designing. Anybody in the world can basically own that token at that point in time. And we generally work with so there's two things that are really important. One is getting the cryptocurrency into the fans of a real community. So it's not just the creator that feels like, oh, I'm going to benefit if this token becomes more widely used and widely held, but it's a real community that comes together. The second is that, you know, we work with the creators to generate at least one really great use case that you can use with your cryptocurrency, whether that's early access or specific types of content, whether that's buying merchandise or other playing a game with the creator or getting access to unique music, you know, from the creator. And then once the token's live, anybody in the world can see how many people own the token, how many transactions are happening, what is the size of the economy, and then the global market of crypto participants can also participate within that economy as well.
I mean, yeah, it's an incredibly wild idea, but it's already working. Like, you've already got many people using your service. I'm going to ask some clarifying questions to make sure I fully understood. So when you say someone buys a crypto, buys a token, so let's say we create a coin, right? Mm-hmm. Or actually another one, Joe Rogan coin, because Joe Rogan's actually already really successful as a podcaster. Let's say 10 years ago, whenever he started it, he issued this coin and people who were early to the show were like, oh, I really like this guy, I'd love to support. Previously, what they could do is buy some of his merch, join his Patreon if he had one, and pay for his like live performances. But in this way, instead of just paying for that in dollars, you're essentially buying into the ecosystem of Joe Rogan in this case. And over time, as his profile grew and that community grew, the value of that coin, I assume, would have more demand, and therefore the price of it goes up. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct. And I think one really important part is that over that 10 years, you know, because Joe Rogan, in this case, would have, you know, mined his own token in the very beginning and gotten a large kind of the initial chunk of tokens, we see a lot of our creators do this, which is they start rewarding their fans. So we have, you know, a super fan and, you know, of one of our streamers, Ali Straza, who bought a bunch of their tokens, gave it to her. She then gave it back to the fan because The fan was just contributing so much to her community. And so we see it being a real two-way sort of interaction where creators are creating ways for their fans to earn the token. So the fans don't just need to buy it. They can earn the tokens for contributing services and just making the community a great place to hang out for the other fans. That's something that creators absolutely want to reward. And so it really becomes, so imagine if Joe Rogan gave you, 10,000 of his coins, 5 years ago, and it continued on its way to becoming a bigger and bigger star. So it becomes a real economy where the fans are sometimes donating and supporting to help the creator out when the creator needs it and is early in creating the content. The creators are then rewarding fans that are contributing along the way. Fans then, once we start seeing communities get into the hundreds of fans that own these tokens, there becomes more fan-to-fan interactions too. So when people are hanging out at a Discord or a Twitch channel, they may say, oh, thank you for, helping to moderate and get that troll out of this, community. Here's 5 tokens. Thank you so much for all your work. So it becomes a real sort of cryptocurrency that's used by a community of people who really believe in this particular case and around kind of the mission or content or values of what that creator is trying to accomplish.
Love it, man. Yeah, that's just really interesting. What are the alternatives, like, for someone who's on the other side of this argument, I guess, to say, okay, I don't fully think I should be doing this. Like, what are they trying to say? Like, what would be their best argument against doing this?
Probably the scariest thing about cryptocurrency that the argument against it would be, well, I don't want the price to be fluctuating. And
volatility.
And that is a very good, it's not going to be for everyone. And cryptocurrency, by its nature, it's not a claim against cash flows or profit or revenue from the creator. It's really about the supply and demand. How is the currency being used in the community? Who's earning it? Who's buying it? Who's creating new services for it? So I think the price volatility of cryptocurrency is just one of the things that is just inherent about it. Now, we've all seen the volatility of the Bitcoin or Ethereum or anything else. And this is a true cryptocurrency. So it lives on the open market, and depending on how people want to buy it or sell it or exchange it, the price will fluctuate. And so it is one of the things that over a very, just like in any other arena, where over a long term, if the creator and the community are really building value together, everyone's going to do fantastic. But in the very, very short term, there can be price volatility that causes some pain. But I think without that level of, without that sort of, financial risk or economic risk, there also isn't the appropriate sort of upside in ways that the community can benefit together. Right. Completely. So what we all want is a creator and millions of fans all using and sharing in a token economy, and in over a 10-year period of time, that grows to become the next, Dogecoin or other successful community coin, and everyone benefits from that. And clearly, if you look back 5 years of Dogecoin, if you participated 5 years ago to today, you'd be doing fantastic. But in the very short term, of course, there's volatility.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I'm going to bring up one example of a guy I've had on the show who's become a friend of mine, Jack Butcher. He's got an account at Visualize Value. He's got about 400,000 followers on his different channels. And he's got quite a thriving community, which is like, I think, $99 or $150 a year people join. It's like a Slack community where people can speak and that sort of stuff. So he has a thriving community already where people pay dollars or fiat currency in this scenario. Mm-hmm. And let's say he does launch an NFT, which is essentially for him might be a piece of artwork that might be like 50 or 100 of them. And the people who end up buying that are buying into him as a creator. Like, they know that if his value and awareness of him and his work continues to improve over time, potentially the price and value of that might also improve. So, for someone like him, like, why would he go down this route of creating a coin versus just going down that pure artwork NFT route?
Yeah, it's a great, great question. I think that there hasn't been a unified way to create an economy just yet. So this is one of the things I'm really passionate about, and I think this space is evolving towards. But imagine this: if you were selling, let's say this week I sold an NFT or a set of NFTs, and let's say in US dollar terms that ended up being $10,000, and I've promised as a creator that I'm going to continue making new sets of NFTs every single week or every single month. And then the next week I sell another $10,000 of NFTs. And the next week I sell another $10,000 of NFTs. Well, if I denominated all of my NFTs in my own cryptocurrency token, so the only way to buy that NFT is to use the Bilal coin to buy the Bilal NFTs, you can imagine that the currency, the cryptocurrency at that point would be worth many multiples of what any one particular NFT drop was. Arguably, even if the first NFT drop did $10,000, what would the cryptocurrency economy size look like? Because there's that use case of, the only way to buy these NFTs are with this cryptocurrency. So it's a way that you can, I think these two things kind of work together, just like in a real economy where you have different types of goods and services that are being created, and then a money system that allows you to denominate those goods and services in a way that facilitates the exchange of those goods and services, allows other types of participants to participate. And one of the beautiful things about cryptocurrency that's just starting right now is the ability to borrow against cryptocurrency, to lend cryptocurrency. And so all those things can start to happen around the creator economy. So imagine that you have a super fan that really wants that piece of work. Well, they may be able to borrow some cryptocurrency to buy that piece of work if they don't have the money just right now, but they just need a little bit more. They borrow a little bit and they could buy that good. And for the creator, then at that point, they don't need to necessarily wait until they get the fifth. Let's say the creator needs to buy a house or needs to buy a car. And so they're selling $10,000 of NFTs a week. Normally they have to wait however many weeks or months or years to basically make the purchase that they want. Well, what would happen if they have their own currency that enables the facilitation of that NFT? So one of the ways that I kind of think about it is where we see this kind of having played out in practical reality has been in the games industry. So if you go play Fortnite, you need the V-Bucks in Fortnite to go buy the different items, in Fortnite, or if you're most likely your kids are playing Roblox, they need to go buy the Robux to then go buy any of the specific digital items in the game. And we see with these game economies, number one, they all use some sort of their own currency to denominate all of their transactions, because it gives so much more flexibility to have your own currency. Everyone all the games generally tend to do that, and then you denominate all of the items in the game in that currency.
So could you go into that a bit more? Like, why is it more beneficial for the game to have their own currency versus just dollars?
So there's a bunch of different reasons that this is the case. One is every game company, when you have a digital, when you have a global audience, when your audience is not just Americans or people from the UK. So how do you denominate something in a way that satisfies everything, right? If you played a game and you had to get the Chinese yuan to, you log into your game and you're like, okay, you've got 25 Chinese yuan. For most Americans, you'd be like, what is that? How do I even think about that, right? So if there's one particular currency, and now obviously the US dollar is considered the global reserve currency, but there's still many people who don't think in terms of dollars. So if you have a game and it's being played by people from 150 different countries, the ability to create a new currency that becomes the game economy currency is really important. So for any podcaster, YouTuber, creator that has an audience from all sorts of different countries around the world, having your own currency will help allow your community to connect around your brand in a lot easier way.
Got it. That's a great point. I didn't think of that.
The second thing is that having a currency allows you to do unique things with it. So if I wanted to, again, reward my moderator or YouTube editor or audio editor, sure, I can go reach into my bank account and I can pay them you know, $500. Thank you for doing a great job on editing my set of, you know, podcast clips. And I could do that for sure. Or if I had my own currency and I was the one who created it and my community has started as the backing of the cryptocurrency, et cetera, has been kind of proven out in the marketplace. Let's imagine it's a year forward. I could then pay my moderator. I could pay my editors in this currency that that I have. And so it becomes a much easier way to facilitate transactions because it again, if I'm living in the US and I've got a video editor based in Australia, I could pay that person much more easily without having to reach into my bank account, do a bunch of currency, you know, conversions, et cetera. And I know that they could take their cryptocurrency and exchange it on their Australian exchange or, you know, a number of mechanisms that are becoming easier and easier in crypto to then pay for goods and services. So it just becomes a lot easier to sort of create real two-way exchanges and again, peer-to-peer exchanges of value. So it's not even just the creator paying a fan or a fan paying a creator, but fan-to-fan kind of interactions, right? So for example, let's say you've created your, you know, you have a Bilal NFT that's amazing and everyone wants it and I buy it. I was the first one to buy it and another fan wants to buy it for me. Well, the natural way to denominate that would be in the Bilal currency over time. So those are the different ways that, so then I'm transacting with another fan in this currency that we all know is part of the, you know, the economy and community that is forming around the world around this particular content or creator.
Got it, man. That makes sense. Okay. So, I'm just trying to wrap my head around that last part there. So on the example of the editor, just to play devil's advocate there. So my current editor, she wants to pay for her bills in, you know, dollars, obviously, like she lives in the States. So would it not be an extra like step for her to have to receive Bilal coin and then have to convert that on Rally or Coinbase or wherever else that she's able to do that?
You're right. There is, if you're in the exact, if you're in the same country and you're using the same currencies already, there's probably less value, you know, to that.
But she would have the upside of the economy that I would be building over time.
And that would be then probably the kind of more of the primary is that if your editor was just every single month converting 100% of their cryptocurrency payments into US dollars because they need to pay their bills, that probably this process would add a bit more friction, you know, to
it.
But let's say she said, oh, okay, well, I need to pay some bills. I'm going to sell 50% of my cryptocurrency, but I want to, you know, I believe in Bilal. I believe in the mission. I believe in this community and what we're trying to do here. And I'm going to keep 50% to continue to participate in this economy, you know, that would be something that would make more sense. Or
so it's almost like stock options, like for a creator, like the way a company. I don't know if you like to use that comparison, but like
we very much think of Rally as like not an investment.
You know? Okay,
not think about this as a an investment in a traditional sense. It really is meant to be to help facilitate an economy, to facilitate multi-way sort of, you know, payments, to facilitate, you know, those types of things. So we do think like, well, over again, very long-term things in the cryptocurrency world have done, you know, quite well. It's much more about how do we enable, you know, kind of these real economies and communities that can be global in nature, that could be you paying the editor, then, you know, maybe they have somebody else that provides them a service and they can exchange value really easily without having to constantly go through kind of their traditional financial system.
Got you. No, that's fair enough. And I can imagine, like, even if it was that, the way I described it as stock options is more as like the upside that you get. So if I work at Google, like I did, I would get paid a salary and a bonus, and then I would get a huge chunk in stock, and I would then have the choice to either convert that to $5 or keep that for a long time, because I thought that being a part of the company, the price would go up, or like it would, the value of it would go up. But in your case, it's not just about the value going up, it's also being able to transact and be a part of that community, get access to stuff. So that makes sense to me, and I get both of them. But I was just thinking, as an amateur, I would obviously, like, if I was buying Joe Rogan coin, yeah, well, I'd love to use some of that to get access to his gigs or like something else, but I would probably be keeping it as well, because I think the value would go up. So I'm sure that is a motivator for some people.
Yeah, it can be. I think we generally think of the NFTs as being where value can potentially increase over time, and that the currency is really meant to be a facilitation of that economy. So I think if Joe Rogan had a, you know, one of one NFT that was incredibly rare and everyone knew who the owner of that one NFT was, I think that NFT could potentially, you know, increase in value.
And what makes sense,
because it is there's no more of them that could ever be created. So I think those types of concepts, again, all blended together in a digital economy, is what is incredibly powerful for any creator to basically unlock and create, you know, in the cryptocurrency world. And it doesn't, it's a new digital economy that can be created that is a much, in some ways, harder to sort of wrap your head around, okay, what does this new world look like? But imagine in a world where there's these different NFTs that are trading for millions of dollars, as we now all see in the news. What does that economy look like? How does that value get created? And I think that's kind of the exciting frontier that we're all exploring right now.
That's awesome. No, thanks for simplifying it for me, man. So you've mentioned there a couple times gaming, in-game purchases, virtual goods. Let's talk a little bit about Kabam, because this, for context, people who haven't heard, I saw you, the company ended up, it was around for 11 years, or you were there for 11 years, it's still around. It got up to like $400 million in revenue a year, from what I could see, and eventually you sold it in several, I think it was sold several times. Or could you clarify that? Like, because I read it was almost $1 billion in value generated, but I wasn't completely sure like what that meant.
Right. So Kabam did have an interesting way that we ended up, exiting. So Kabam had three different studios around the world, one in Canada, one in China, and then one in Los Angeles. And we, instead of selling all three, so one of the studios made fighting games, another studio made strategy games, and then another studio made kind of a new format of games that we were still exploring. And so the LA studio got sold to 20th Century Fox. Our Canadian studio got sold to Netmarble for the highest kind of price. That's generally the one that people think about on news. And our China studio got sold to a China, based
buyer.
And so between those three studios, instead of selling them all under kind of one umbrella, they had, our first buyer just wanted the Canadian studio. So that was kind of the first transaction that ended up happening. And then we ended up selling 20th Century Fox, which then got bought by Disney, and then subsequently got bought by Scopely. So yes, you're right. The LA studio ended up changing hands multiple times. And it is now doing something like, several hundreds of millions of dollars in the games that they're producing. So I'm really happy to see the kind of Kabam family go on and create amazing games. And
business is booming. Yeah, that's awesome, man. So it sounds like there were sales from, I saw reported 700 to 800 million up to a billion. So yeah, that makes sense. There's a bunch of them. Either way, hopefully that was a great exit for you and outcome. Again, you mentioned, I think, 500 million people playing the games. Let's go into the gaming industry a little bit more, man, because this is something, like I mentioned earlier, the gaming industry is one of the best for innovating early, whether it's a new technology, new business models, testing out new ways to do things. So I'd love to go into a few of those, because I think you're definitely an expert in this. Where do we start? Because from my research, it looks like there's 2.5 billion people in the world playing games, which is kind of crazy, right? Because like my parents listening to this are probably thinking, wow, like they just probably think that gaming is for kids, which I know for sure isn't the case. And of course, like, plenty of adults play. Another misconception is that it's only men that play, which, I again, digging into the research, is definitely not true. It's very distributed. But from what I can see, men skew more to like console gaming, and then women on average skew more to mobile gaming. But again, I don't know enough about this. So yeah, like, from your point of view, like, what does the state of gaming look like for this decade?
I think it's very exciting right now. There's a lot of different dimensions of gaming. Gaming tends to have been a very early and probably one of the biggest content categories for pretty much any computing device. So going back to the days and where we started this interview, where I was kind of assembling PCs and without hard drives and so forth, you know, one of the big applications even back then were these games on floppy disks. And then we moved to arcades, right? So as the hardware got better, so as a precursor to console or kind of as console was taking off, you had these kind of purpose-built hardware that got put into these arcades, and then the business model there was you put a quarter or two in to go play a game, in an arcade. Then we moved into kind of the console era with Nintendo, Sony, and Xbox, and so forth. And then that was kind of the dominant model for a while. And then when I started Kabam was when it was starting to move, games were starting to move from console into the internet. And so there were, whether it was a pure kind of browser-based game, like you would go to, armorgames.com or minigames.com or something like that, and you could play like pool and solitaire. And I mean, imagine even like actually going back to even Windows, the original Windows 3.1, I think, or something like that, had solitaire and Minesweeper and a few other games like that that were pretty big back
the
then.
Classics.
If you were using Windows back then. What happened it remained kind of niche. So gaming was a little bit niche until the mid 2000s. And then what happened then was two things. One is social. So the rise of Facebook and, Facebook, when they launched their platform, they had not even imagined games. They were really talking about people sharing news and photos and all these other things. But gaming just came to absolutely crush the entire Facebook platform to a point where Facebook very publicly said multiple times, we don't know what to do about gaming because it's so big, but it's also very polarizing, where if somebody's sharing their gaming, achievements, half of your friends kind of hate it. And then half of your friends are like, oh, cool, let me go join you and play the game. And it was very polarizing. And the social made gaming explode. And so gaming reached multiple hundreds of millions of new gamers during the Facebook, platform era.
And that was like, just to share a few examples, like Zynga was obviously a massive player, but Farmville, people probably remember the notifications even if you weren't playing.
Your cow wandered onto your farm, go claim it. That game alone, I think that game alone at its height had 100 million active, players in it. And then you had many other games that were in the multiple tens of millions. And then, of course, the major thing that's kind of pushed gaming to the 2.5 billion level is just smartphones. So the advent of smartphones, and then taking the business model that was pioneered during the social gaming standpoint, which is you start playing the game for free. So now when you download a game on your phone, you expect it generally to be free. To download the game and start playing it. You can now download the game, start playing it for free on your mobile device. And then if you like to, you kind of pay for different virtual items along the way. And that's now, so it's the console era was probably like 50 to 100 million in terms of total worldwide, gamers. And then in the social era, it moved into the many multi hundreds of millions. And in the smartphone era of games, we've now moved into the billions of people playing games actively.
That's insane. And could you go into the way as a game owner, monetization wise, it sounds like the virtual goods and the in-game purchases are how you make most of the money nowadays, right? Like, what does that look like on a percentage level? Is that like half of your revenues coming from there? I'm curious, like, obviously it varies by game, but from your experience, what does that look like?
There's a few different business models now. So Kabam's business model was always 100% focused on microtransactions because we made games that were, we called them more mid-core games. And so they, we would generally hit audiences in the tens of millions. So we, our games weren't as easy to pick up as like a Farmville, for example, or Subway Surfer, or you know, Fruit Ninja, or Angry Birds or something like that. But they weren't nearly as hardcore as like a Call of Duty or something like that. So we generally, you know, we call them the, these mid-core games, and generally those types of games monetize best by being 100% focused on microtransactions. We now are moving into one of the eras of gaming that's now happening. It's called hyper-casual. So hyper-casual is even more casual than casual, and these like little time wasters that you only expect to play for a couple minutes, and then you can kind of, you know, go on to the next session or stop or whatever. And so you play it in a bus, play it in a subway, on your before the pandemic where we were all commuting. And so hyper-casual is now generally more ad-driven. And so you download the game. You can buy some premium things in there every once in a while, but they're really such short casual things that they monetize best through ads, actually. And so these are games that are many hundreds of millions of players and all over the world. And they generally monetize a little bit through ads and a combination of premium items. And on the other side, you do have still the very, you know, core games, whether it's a console game, a Call of Duty, et cetera. They charge you the, you know, $50, $60 or whatever still to buy the game. And then you can still, you know, buy additional items along the way. So like FIFA is probably the best example of this, where you still pay for the great game that they make every year, but then the FIFA Ultimate and a few other things now allow you to spend tens of thousands of dollars, you know, in the game to buy.
Yeah, that's, you know, the one I do know about. So FIFA, and also I think so thanks for that overview. Where would you put like a Fortnite? Because I don't play Fortnite, but I know it's a really interesting example.
So Fortnite has pioneered yet another one that's, depending on how you define it, it's they generally focus on what's called a battle pass, which is a subscription payment. And the battle pass gives you a whole bunch of different things in the game and so forth. So it's really packages up all the free to, so it's free to play, you know, Fortnite still. And then if you want to, you can buy individual skins and rare items, but generally they try to funnel the player base into a subscription payment, such that you know exactly how much you're going to pay. And then you get a bunch of premium currency, premium goods and other things in the game for buying the subscription.
Got it. And again, for someone who doesn't play a game, an example of this is, I think there was like a Batman skin, or like they've got all these like cool looking things that are virtual, but you pay to upgrade your character, your avatar, whatever within the game. And I think for people who don't play games, they're just like, why would someone do that? But we don't have to, you know, try to convince people here. It's already happening at scale. Hundreds of millions of people are doing this already. But just from your understanding, like, what is the motivation? Is it this? Is it just to stand out? Is it because they feel a sense of personalization? Is it just they get so much enjoyment from that? Like, you must have like gone into the psychology of the gamer in this case.
Yeah, you know, it is all about community. So I would argue, you know, there are, because we're talking about such huge numbers of people playing games, if you created a single player game where there's no community, there's no interactions in the game, some small percentage, I would argue probably in the 1-2% range, would probably still buy something to look a little bit different and customize their character in the game. It just tends to happen. There's 1-2% of people that are like, you know, nobody else sees this, but I see it and I care about it. And so I'll pay the extra $10, $30 to, you know, get a new thing that I can look at. In games that are like Fortnite, that are hype, that are very community centric, you drop into a map, everyone sees each other for a while, and you're sort of running around. And especially these days where you're playing on Twitch, you have you have highlights that you then post to YouTube and so forth, and everyone sees like the thing that you're wearing, right? And so so if you're a Twitch streamer, you don't want to be like running around with the generic avatar and the generic stuff. You want that, you know, cool Batman thing, or you want the crazy, you know, fish gun or whatever it is. And so you're willing to spend $10, $20 to go buy that thing because you're streaming on Twitch and you want to signal to your audience that I'm a serious gamer and I got the cool new thing, just like I've got the cool new sneakers or watch or anything else that that you pay as a status, there's a bit of a status, a single.
Yeah, it's the same reason you want to look good in person. This is just people living in a virtual world, essentially. So
that's right.
It's a similar psychology, but just in different contexts.
That's right. So it really is all about these communities that form, which is why, going back to Rally, we're so excited about helping creators really kind of tie that community together. And again, help certain fans stand out and signal that, hey, I'm a huge fan. Like, I'm a really, really big fan. I want to signal that to the creator. I also want to signal that to the other fans. You can imagine in a sports, setting that you have these sports super fans that they want to stand out and they want to be known as the biggest, Yankees fan, Niners fan, Warriors fan, whatever it may be, right? And I think that happens also with creators. You have every creator knows a few super fans that just love their work. And sometimes those fans want to be anonymous, which is another fascinating thing. And actually, they'll pay a lot of money to be anonymous and a supporter.
And that's interesting.
The psychology will be, I want to be a huge supporter and I want everyone to know about it. And actually, we see both things kind of happen.
That's very interesting. That brings up the kind of like another big trend in the space, which is the streaming. And of course, this is across many industries, but gaming has been one of the leading areas for streaming, specifically Twitch and YouTube, I think, are the two biggest players. So could you share like a little bit of context around that? Like, what does that world look like? Because I remember meeting someone many years ago who was an executive at like EA or one of the big gaming shops. And he said something which I don't know is completely accurate, but he told me something along the lines of, there's more time spent people watching games than people playing games, or something crazy like that. And it didn't seem to make like mathematical sense to me in my head. I was like, how does that even work? But like, yeah, either way, there's a lot of people watching people playing games. So like, could you share a little bit more color around that?
Yeah, it absolutely exploded and all. And I think it's just fascinating. I mean, you can log on to Twitch and some of the top, streamers will have 50,000, 100,000 people watching them at that moment. And so if you just do the math, you have one person playing and then 50,000 people watching, it's, 50,000x, the multiplier in terms of playing versus, watching. And it's a huge phenomenon. It's only growing, and it's really, different parts of the world have taken off in very different ways. And in China, for example, there are two massive $10 billion, companies that basically were created that competed against Twitch, and they've since merged together. Twitch, of course, as we talked about, YouTube, have now really, like, these four different platforms have combined, almost a billion, people sort of like watching people play games. It's really fascinating. And it's not just on PC anymore. It started with PC because it was easy. The software that's required to take the video feed, the audio feed, and a bunch of overlays and all this other stuff, and then stream it out to the, to people all around the world who want to watch real time. That kind of happened on a PC, or Mac setup. But these days it's really happening on mobile games. I mean, mobile games are very talked about, really dramatically increased the total playing base from hundreds of millions of gamers to billions of gamers. And now what's just starting to happen is the ability to take your mobile game play that you're playing and then stream that out to another, a billion other people who want to watch you play your mobile game. It's just a fascinating world.
It's incredible.
It's no longer constrained to just gameplay. And so people will be cooking. There's shows about people eating. people are using these live streaming platforms. I really kind of started with gaming as kind of the core. It have now kind of branched off where these other categories are actually in aggregate larger than the gaming category now. So on Twitch, the largest,
oh, wow.
Depending on the time and if no other tournaments are running and so forth, the kind of just chatting, segment is larger than all the gaming.
That makes sense. Yeah, and I guess it comes back to something I was talking about yesterday in a conversation I had with the founder of Morning Brew, is mm-hmm. that if you take what has happened for generations, right, like there are TV shows that have always worked. There's a talk show, there's Oprah, there's the QVC live sales channel, there's Shark Tank, that style. And creating new versions of that is a really interesting business model, just like an idea machine anyway. Yeah. And I think like we're seeing the same now with live streaming, because previously there's always been live TV. Well, not always, but for a long time, there's been live TV. And if you just think of those categories, live news, live sports, and now we're just seeing that translate into something else. So there is live news on the internet, you know, plenty of those from the existing news channels. But before they did it, there were these YouTubers like the Young Turks, who's mm-hmm. my first ever guest on the show. They were doing it for a long time. And then you've got entertainment, like sports, obviously. But this is esports now, right? So like that's a great segue into the next part, which I was curious about, which is esports, which is also an incredible phenomenon. And just to paint a picture for people who don't know what esports is, there are stadiums full of people, the same stadiums that we watch basketball stars or soccer, football stars in, being filled up with fans, seeing people play professional, you know, console gaming or whatever. And you happen to be involved in this space with Gen G. Is that right? Gen G, right? And it's one of the biggest esports orgs in the world. So you know all about this world. So what am I missing in that context? Like, what is going on in this space for people like my parents who are watching, who are like, what are you talking about? People are watching people play games live and paying to be there. Well, what's going on there, man?
Yeah, this is just fascinating. And so one of the first things I did after I saw Kabam was I said, you know what, this esports, it's just so fascinating. And I have to like start an esports team. I want to own an esports team. So I started Gen G a few months after I saw Kabam. And what esports is that, first of all, it is certain types of games. So it's not every game, but esports will generally, on Twitch, pretty much every single game in the world is streamed in some fashion. Esports typically does refer to games that are designed to be hyper-competitive. So to give you a sense, it'd be the same as like there's no professional scene around checkers. Because there's only so many moves and things you can do in checkers that really the what we call the skill cap is just not very high. The very best moves you can make in checkers is just not that, you can't exhibit that much skill. But then you move to chess, and now you've got a game that obviously has been played professionally for hundreds of years. And so games are like that too. It's not that every game, not every game is a chess. There's a lot of games that are like checkers, where they're fun games and they're competitive, but they're not designed to allow the best players in the world to really shine. So there's games like League of Legends, like Overwatch, and Rocket League and a few others that have really emerged to be these incredibly hyper-competitive games that everyone understands. There is a very, very high, almost unlimited skill level that you can display in these games. And they've become, these games have become developed in their scene enough where the top players in the world are now making, the top League of Legends player in the world makes somewhere between $3 to $5 million a year. In salary. And so we're getting to kind of professional sport level in terms of what salaries can look like. And then, as you mentioned, these games are now filling up traditional sports stadiums, and it's just kind of wild to see, and the energy level is fantastic. And so it's a crazy world. I must profess that I don't fully understand, it myself in terms of how passionate people are about, players and teams. But you basically take this, you take this game that you may have 100 million people play, like League of Legends, and then you say, okay, the top 100 players in the world, people want to really watch these people, and we'll travel all throughout the world to watch them. And then the other thing that we just talked about that intersects is that a lot of these players will go on after a match, and they'll go on to Twitch, and they'll stream, and they'll just be talking to their fans. And so there's this authenticity and connection with the fan base that can be global and instantaneous in a way that, is just a little bit different than in sports, where you may have a press interview or a media interview after the game by a player, but you know, a lot of times a League of Legends player or Overwatch player, they'll go stream for hours, you know, after a match, and they just hang out and kind of talk with their fans, talk about, oh, here's what I was thinking here, and I wish I did this, or I made this mistake, or I thought this other player did something amazing here. And, you know, it's just amazing to have that kind of interactivity all blend together. And that's what's driving esports right now, is that authenticity, that connection, and that hyper competitiveness that allow true skill to be displayed.
Yeah, man, it's the most incredible thing. And I'd just say, from my point of view, it makes complete sense in hindsight. It's just when you first hear it, you're like, what? There are people watching people playing games live. It sounds crazy to someone who doesn't play games. But then check myself and say, okay, I support Arsenal football team, right? And I listen to 4 podcasts a week. Like, literally, I pay for more content to hear the stats, or on the stats podcast. They do a tactics breakdown of every game. They're talking about the preview for the next game. And one of my first businesses, if you can call it that, was an Arsenal blog, where I wrote about this every few days as well. So I just know, like, following a team, it's not a rational thing. It's about enjoyment. You're right. Like, I know it's completely irrational. Like, I shouldn't be listening to that much about Arsenal, but that's, you know, something I'm passionate about. So similarly,
that's what it is.
I think it's a few things. It's like nostalgia. Like, you know, that's something that we all, you know, have nostalgia playing games, or for me, playing football, or like going to the game for the first time with my dad. And like, you know, that there's all these great feelings you get from it. And then there's also the progress. Like, when you support a team, you enjoy it so much more than just watching a random game. Like, I rarely watch other games because, you know. And then I think the last part is just, we are all fascinated by the top performers in any industry. There's a reason we all watch Billions as a show, because even though, one, because it's a great show, but also it's kind of cool to see like a fictional character who resembles one of the best hedge fund managers. To most people, hedge funds are boring as hell, but just to see what goes into their process is really interesting. And the same with sports stars. We want to see Messi play because he's the next level of a player, and he does things none of us can do. Similarly, if I'm watching someone play League of Legends or whatever, and I play it every day, and I can see, oh wow, look at that, how quickly he adjusted there or whatever. So I completely get it, and I think a lot of people just aren't open-minded enough to understand. You know, if it's not for you, that's fine. But there are other people who really gain from something like this. And then the last part, I think, is community. Like you said, it all comes back to feeling a connection. You know, like, we are tribes overall, like as humans. And I completely understand that I'm part of the Arsenal tribe. It's, again, not a rational thing. But if I meet someone and we meet in the Arsenal pub down the road, I can like hug them because we scored a goal. And I don't even know that person, you know. It's a weird phenomenon. So I think there's just there's a need for connection in that way as well. So I think it's super cool. So the one other thing I'm curious about is really just on the opportunity side. So we've talked about what you're doing with Rally. We've talked about esports and the gaming world. Like, if you look at the next decade of innovation in this space, like, where are the areas of opportunity for you? Because you mentioned even bringing NFTs onto your platform, it sounds like. So how are you looking at those different vectors of opportunity?
Well, I think, so my full time is spent on Rally. I still love a lot of things that are going on in the gaming and even esports, you know, side of things. I'm a member of the board of directors. I'm active in generally mentorship and counsel to the CEOs, but I spend most of my time on Rally. And I think, because partly I think the opportunity in crypto, I could not be more excited. It really is there's a fundamental change in both the way that technology and the way that people use the technology is happening, that I think is so fundamental. And we're just at the very beginnings of still. And so I encourage everyone who's listening, who sort of, I don't get this Bitcoin thing or so forth, Crypto is one of those things that it transcends nations. In some cases, I see a lot of people who are into crypto that almost treat it like a religion, and I don't think that that's healthy necessarily. But there's certainly people who use religious terms to describe their crypto experience. But I think of it as just, you know, we've organized the world, we've organized in countries, we've organized in governments, in policy. But have we ever really thought about how human beings exchange value and services? And what does money represent? How does community, what is the community that you're a part of anymore, right? So as we move from, it used to be when I grew up in a small town, you know, my neighbors were, that was my community. I cared a lot about them. And I would argue that most people now feel like they have way less connection to their neighbors than they have to some community that they found online. And that is something that is a fundamental shift in how humans and how technology has enabled humans to connect with people all around the world. Right? I may care more about my esports team. I may have a health condition that I don't know anybody in my town has, but I found a community online that we all share this condition and we're all trying to get through it and learn how to cope with it, et cetera. Or I may have a community of people that I share, you know, a hobby or something with, and it's all, you know, increasingly these days, you know, online, and that connects you with people all over the world. And I think, you know, so what does money mean when communities are now different, governments are now doing things with money that, you know, that I don't think anybody in the world thinks is that healthy in terms of the unlimited printing of money, you know, that is happening. How do we all think about kind of these things? And I think crypto has some answers to a lot of this stuff, and in many other ways it doesn't have the answers. We're all still trying to figure it out. But I would argue that crypto is now probably some of the most exciting economic developments that are happening there. And just encourage everyone to you know, have an open mind towards it. And especially if you're a potential entrepreneur, I think there's just so many opportunities to explore, you know, in the crypto space. As we talked about earlier, I think there's certain disciplines that I think will just have world-changing impacts, whether that's climate change or biotech or AI or a few other, you know, things that I think most people would be like, oh yeah, that's in the next 10, 20 years is going to have humongous, you know, impacts, and very excited about that. But they do require very specific sort of training and education and practicing. Maybe climate change is a little bit more broad and easier, but, you know, obviously if you're going to go start a biotech, you know, sort of startup, it does require a certain type of background to be able to do that.
Definitely. Yeah, so because I'm a big fan of cryptocurrency overall and blockchain. I've been holding for some time. I've never sold anything. For me, like the way I've always thought about it was, okay, this seems like something very interesting. I don't fully get it when I first got into it, but I was like, okay, this is something that has the potential to be quite revolutionary in a way, like very, very different to what we're currently seeing and used to. And there's probably smarter people out there than me who understand it, and let me kind of follow some of their signals. That's kind of how I originally thought of it. Then when I started digging into Bitcoin and then eventually Ethereum and then all the other things that are going on in that world, I was like, wow, this makes a lot of sense in the long run. But in the short term, there's going to be crazy volatility in price. We're still trying to figure out real use cases. And I think even just the Bitcoin case is an interesting one, where it started off with this narrative of a medium of exchange and an actual currency. And now I think the primary kind of narrative is around digital gold and a store of value over time. I heard Ethereum being described as like the digital oil almost, because it's kind of like making other things work. But let's go forward, and this is not us trying to predict, right? Because none of us can really predict, but we're just having a conversation about it. Like, if we were looking 10 years from now, how do you see this evolving? You know, because right now people are really concentrating primarily in the press anyway around the price of assets, and understandably, because everyone wants to make a quick buck if they can. But I think you are a lot deeper in this world and understand the mechanics of it better than I do. So, like, I guess to be more pointed, let's start off with the problem, because you mentioned unlimited printing of money, for example. Like, what is wrong with that? For someone who doesn't understand the macroeconomic environment, what is wrong with a government printing so much money like we have over the last few years, in your opinion?
I think the there's a lot of different forces at play with economies currently. Obviously, global economies today are incredibly complex. But I think this idea that the government can continue doing multi-trillion-dollar stimuluses, and it's not just any one government. It's actually the crazy thing is it's every major government around the world doing this. And it has a bunch of different effects. One is, I think, just for the average person, it's like if you're holding a dollar in a bank account, it's just becoming less valuable. We talked a little bit about scarcity and NFTs and so forth before. You know, if there was, you know, previously a certain supply of money in the world, and now there's another $2 trillion, you know, dollars of supply in the world without anything else changing, you know, clearly every dollar is worth just a little bit less. And there's a lot of arguments and discussion these days about how traditional measures of inflation don't necessarily capture, you know, some of these things accurately anymore, depending on the way that the, you know, CPI scales and other things are happening. But I think one is that we're just in this world where governments, for some reason, we've ended up, you know, into this world where governments run major deficits, and then we just keep printing money. And we don't want to cover the deficits, you know, through pure fiscal, you know, constraint. And there, you know, obviously there's major health crises and other, you know, very, very large, really important issues that we all need that governments, you know, are facing all around the world. So I'm not saying that there's no good reason for it. There clearly is many good reasons for doing it, but it's also one that if this is the only world we live in where we have to, you know, live with the US dollar and the US government is running a massive deficit and just massively printing money, this doesn't, there's no future where this just continues forever, I think is kind of how I think a lot of smart people would think about it. And so what is the alternative to this thing? Well, the alternative is I go buy some yen, I go buy some euro, but those governments are also doing something very similar. So there is a, and so does that leave us in a world where entrepreneurs are figuring out a new form of money? And I would argue that that is, you know, one of the things that should absolutely be experimented with, because it's not clear that this current path of just major deficits and major stimulus will continue for the next 50 years. I hope that there's broader debate and dialogue, you know, around these kind of things. But I think that is one of the problems that crypto does solve, is that instead of depending on the government for your money. So if in the past, you know, when I was growing up, I take my money and I put it into US savings bonds. And I said, okay, great. I trust this form of money. I trust what the interest rates that the government are providing. I'm going to go participate in that economy. But I think these days what crypto offers is a different way to say, you know what, I'm not going to hold 100% of my basket of assets in US dollar denominated assets. I'm going to do things that are different, and that from a software and technology standpoint, guarantee scarcity, guarantee certain things that are actually kind of rooted in sound economic theory, even though for a lot of people, it may just be like Bitcoin's up 10% today, Bitcoin's down 5%, whatever, you know, it is crazy. But the one thing that will always be true is that there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin ever, and that will never change. Some people believe in that and that having value. Some other people don't believe in that because it's like not clear what you could use it for. But I think over time, you know, whether it's you could buy your Teslas, you know, with Bitcoin, you could buy, there's other, you know, you could buy other goods and services that you need in crypto. I think all of those things are coming and evolving down the road very soon.
Yeah, completely, Matt. No, I think that's a great point. And I guess, to play this out a little bit more, because is the theory that the volatility will reduce over time as as let's say the price continues to increase and there's more adoption of crypto overall, and the liquidity is kind of like flowing a little bit more than it is right now. Is the theory that the volatility would slow down over time because of that, or is that just something I've incorrectly heard?
Yeah, so there are actually a number of projects, actually some of the very largest crypto projects now in terms of market capitalization are what we call stable coins. And they're stable relative to either the US dollar, generally the US dollar, or increasingly there's kind of new projects that are trying to stabilize, create a stable currency against a basket of other relatively stable assets. And so I think if you're looking for things that are stable because you can, take your convenience, everyone needs this level of convenience assets to be able to buy goods and services, pay bills, et cetera. And they're stable assets that basically allow you to accumulate that. And then over time, as the industry evolves, an ability to pay your bills and buy things in these stable assets. So for example, USDT by a company called Tether is stable against the US dollar. And that's, I think, the fifth or sixth largest by market capitalization at this point in terms of crypto value. And so there are the volatility of certain assets is both a plus and a minus, but increasingly, even in the digital world, people are looking for stable assets, and stable coins have become probably one of the biggest classes. I think you're going to see the Chinese government come in with a Chinese yuan that is a digital yuan that will be a digital based asset. The US government, Jerome Powell, talked about how this year the US government will be exploring a digital dollar as well. And so I think we're going to see over the next decade governments all around the world participate in cryptocurrencies with stable government backed crypto collateral.
Yeah, completely. Another thing that's been happening recently in the business world is a lot of prominent companies, or a handful of prominent companies, have been putting Bitcoin on their balance sheet, in their treasury or whatever. So obviously Tesla's the biggest example of that, but I think Square has also done this in the past. There's obviously MicroStrategy with Sailor doing the Bitcoin promotion work on the corporate side. So I'm curious, like, your opinion on that, because your work is obviously, related to this. So as a company, is that something you guys think about? Because you're already dealing in cryptocurrencies and as well. So like, how do you think of that as someone who's running a company like that?
Well, I think we didn't touch on this in the show. We touched on a lot of things, but Rally is not a company. I mean, Rally is a company because that is the way to start something from nothing still. But the kind of the destination or the BHAG for Rally is that Rally will dissolve into something that is not a company anymore. So imagine a world where the next Facebook or Twitter or pick your favorite social platform is not run by a singular company. I think there'd be a lot of good in that in some cases where, and so the way that we think about Rally is, as we focus on creators, we want to end up in probably in the 3-5 year time frame where Ethereum is today, where there's no one company that runs the Ethereum ecosystem. And so that company cannot just change the rules for its own benefit. That company doesn't have to, let's say Myanmar is a great example right now, where you've got this new military government that's just taken over the country. It's really tamping down on all forms of media, and it's now forcing it's a relatively smaller country. So big tech companies may or may not care about that. It's forcing big tech companies through certain types of policies or kicking them out of the country. I think corporations that are sitting there and thinking, okay, do I enable or give the data or requests or censorship privileges to the military government of Myanmar or not? Or do I not operate in that country anymore? It's a level of corporate and ethical dilemma that is, it will continue to be the case, I think, in the foreseeable future. And so it's not that, we're not that many months out or weeks out from the Capitol riots. And what was the, you know, what is the boardroom discussion? What is the corporate governance and decision-making process around censoring the president of the United States or not? And these are, I think, in some ways, impossible decisions that when we, you know, the founding principles of a capitalistic market, and specifically the corporate structure for organizing people and capital to develop products, you know, made a lot of sense when we were talking about factories and so forth. But in a world where it's social media and who makes the decisions about what, you know, who to censor, what information to give, you know, to which parties about what's happening on social media, these are in some ways impossible decisions. And I think where the world should move to, and I'm not sure this is the answer for everything, but I do think there needs to be an alternative, which is, what does Ethereum represent? What does a network that is not run by a single company and a single board of directors, a single CEO, that there needs to be an alternative in the marketplace for that. And I think that is where Rally's headed. I'm really, you know, there's no company or person even that runs Bitcoin. There's no, and similarly, there's nothing about Ethereum that does that. And that's where Rally is headed to, which is as we grow the Rally network, we will dissolve Rally Corporation in such that there will be no company that runs the Rally network. And it will be a true open sourced, you know, open protocol that anybody, any creator, any brand, you know, can create their own forms of digital currency and digital assets without without a singular company that decides what's okay, what's not okay. Do I raise fees this year? Do I drop fees? Do I do something else? So I'm really excited about that for Rally. And just in general, I think this is one of the other directions why I'm so excited about crypto, is it represents a different coordination model than a corporation. And I think that needs, you know, again, in a physical world, a corporation made a lot of sense. In a purely digital world that's run by software, I don't think a traditional corporate entity makes sense for certain categories. And that's one of the avenues that I think the crypto world is pushing forward in a really unique way. And I'm really excited about the ethos of what that represents as an alternative to a corporation.
That's really interesting. Yeah, this is a bigger like philosophical point. Just to make sure I understand, this is the alternative you're describing here as a decentralized organization, I guess, not even a company. I don't know if you call it a company or not.
I'm sorry. Definitely not call out a company. Okay. Corporation. These are things that we very much do not want to be.
And is that just because of the type of business the type of organization you've currently created, or is it more of a philosophical thing that you feel like we need less centralization and more decentralization? So, for example, if you created, like, would you consider this for your other companies that you're involved with, for example, like your esports company?
No. So I do think there's plenty of great reasons for a corporation to exist. I'm not arguing that all corporations are bad by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. But I do argue that whether you want to call it a monopoly, whether you want to call it something else, you know, when corporations in certain categories get so big that they own the entire market, it's one thing if it was Standard Oil or something else that controlled a physical asset, although probably it's not great in those contexts either. But it's a different thing when we give all of our information to a big tech company and they have this incredible amount of data and information, and all of our content and all of our communications goes through that big tech company. And what does that company do to disclose that to governments or to other parties that are trying to monetize or do even potentially nefarious things? What does that mean? And so I do think anything that touches social and people, I actually think like corporations are not necessarily, you know, should not be the organizing principle for many types of social, you know, platforms. And you know, those are where the biggest reaches of you know, the internet is these days. But I do think for, you know, Gen G esports, it'll never, you know, even if Gen G becomes, you know, 100 times bigger than it is today, it's not necessarily harmful to the world for Gen G to be, you know, an arsenal or something like
but
that.
But like a decentralized social network, is actually an interesting alternative to what we currently
have.
Social
networks have to be, you know, I just think that social networks get larger and larger, and they're operating on a global basis across all of these different, you know, countries, that they're going to be put into impossible decisions. There's just impossible ethical, moral, and governance, you know, issues that will arise. I just don't see how that is the best model for a social platform going forward.
And I know this is probably opening up a can of worms right at the end of the time we have, but it's really fascinating. It's a really fascinating idea, and I haven't really thought much about it. But how would, let's say, a decentralized Facebook or Instagram or Twitter work in terms of choosing the product roadmap and the priorities? I guess, like, probably Ethereum is an example of how it does work in one world. But, like, yeah, could you just share a bit of context how that could potentially even work?
I think email is probably the best example. It's obviously very simple, but email is, you know, literally it's an open, there's no corporation that controls email. And it just works, you know, whether you're using Google Gmail, you're using Yahoo Mail still, you're using, you know, Microsoft, you're using the many tens of thousands of email providers all around the world. You can create an email account. You can email anybody else in the world using the email protocol. And no one company, no government controls it. And it can evolve. It's not like it's a static thing. It has evolved. The email protocol has evolved over time. And you know, HTTP is another, you know, protocol that the world over, you know, uses. And no one company, and, you know, there are certain elements that are a little bit centralized and so forth. But I do think that creating, you know, and Twitter has at least publicly said that they're working on something like this. I'm not sure if they'll actually, you know, do it anytime soon. But I do think this idea of, like, what is identity? What is content? Who are you sending that? Like, what are the pipes that content is running through? Who receives and looks at that content? I think you can decentralize those things. And we've done it with email. Email has started in a completely decentralized way. It remains decentralized. You know, there's some limitations. You can't just build around email to make a social media platform the way we would think about it today. But I do think that it is very much possible to create social platforms, social communications, and interactions that are decentralized. At the core, I'm not saying that everything needs to be. A lot of people confuse decentralization with saying everything is decentralized and I've got to do it completely by myself. And there is some of that ethos in crypto, but I do think it looks more like email, where there are corporations that are created to create email services, but no one corporation controls the core of the network. And so any company can start and create a new email service or not. And it's a fair playing ground for everyone involved.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. The last question for you, man, I know we're running out of time now, and this has been really super interesting, man. We've covered so many topics. One thing I'd love to touch on is, I think there's not that many people who get advice on, like, how to live their own lives in terms of their personal finance. And I think something for me growing up that I never really got that much access to were examples from people who had, you know, generated wealth and had figured out a lot of stuff that I hadn't. And to clarify, I'm not saying what you're about to share with us is what everyone should do, but just if you had a 25-year-old son or daughter and they said, hey, dad, I've just started my first job a couple of years ago. I've saved a bit of money. I need to figure out how to invest this over time. I'm just curious what your advice would be to that person.
Oh, that's a great question. I do have young kids, and so not quite at the age yet where they're earning an income to figure out what to invest in it. But I think it's challenging. I think, you know, for me growing up, it was very clear that, you know, and even back when I was growing up, there was probably, like, the investment advice in general would be some mix of fixed income that'd be relatively large, you know, maybe 50%, and then stocks, you know, kind of a basket of that. And I think even, you know, going to 2010, fixed income would be perceived as, you know, losing out in the marketplace, right? You wouldn't want a large fixed income portfolio if you're 25 years old. And I think that became generally general investing wisdom, because fixed income, yields have fallen so greatly. And that's where we end up with TINA, or there is no alternative to stocks. And I do think we're moving into a world where even, sort of stocks aren't, my advice for my kids is to think about stocks and crypto as probably the two asset classes to be a part of, at least at a young age. And then as you get older and older, some much more forms of lower volatility, lower yield bearing assets will probably be appropriate. But for a person in their 20s or 30s, I do think, for what I do, or for the people that I'm involved with, then my advice to my children would be a mixture of stocks and crypto.
No, that makes a lot of sense, man. Well, thanks for sharing that. And listen, man, this has been incredible and so informative for me. My mind is still like spinning everywhere. So I appreciate you going into so much detail around the different worlds. Is there anywhere we should be sending people? Obviously, there's rally.io, and you're at Kevin Chu on Twitter, which we'll share in the show notes. Anything else you'd like to share before we close out?
I one of the greatest things about crypto that is missing in the headlines is the ability to participate. So we have all sorts of ways that you can earn. You can contribute to the community. You could be a developer, for example, and clearly we have developer bounties and other things that you can earn by doing it part-time and building a tool that a streamer or a creator needs to integrate their cryptocurrency into their video feed or sound feed on Clubhouse. There's like all sorts of things. I would encourage you to check out the Rally Discord, which you can, find a link to on rally.io. It's kind of on the bottom right side of the page. You can hang out in our Discord channel. It's a very vibrant community. And not only hang out, but really either find a way to contribute as a developer. If you're not technical or don't have development experience, you can contribute by spreading the word to creators. So we have a referral. So if your favorite podcaster is like Bilal isn't on, on Rally, you can certainly encourage that creator to join Rally and earn a referral fee. And then there's community moderation and other roles and part-time things that you can do to also earn kind of a part income through the Rally community. So, and it's not just Rally, there's many other crypto projects that pretty much every crypto project that is reasonably community run has these types of programs where it's all about getting as many people to participate and contribute to building up this community as possible. What's so great about this is that just as we discussed for creators, you can earn, you can participate, you can contribute, and find something you're passionate about and really kind of get started and not just, buy into it or speculate or anything else, but you can really participate and earn in many different crypto projects, including Rally. So I encourage everyone to go check out.
Love it, man. That's awesome, man. Well, thank you, man. I think it's an incredibly exciting time in this space, and it's really cool to see you really swinging for the fences, man. I haven't seen many ideas that are this big, like from even the people that I've interviewed. So thanks for sharing the behind the scenes, and I'd love to do this again to hear how things are going over the years.
Thank you. It's been great to be on here.
Cheers, man. Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I'll have an episode for you every week. These are raw, uncut, and actionable conversations with the greatest business minds and creators in the world. So make sure you're subscribed. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, BZAIDI, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.